Today is Wednesday, April the 17th, 2024. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know and do you care how big tech companies are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a three-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at PCRadioShow.org. Our website is PCRadioShow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, which is www.prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. T-Mobile could be profiling you right now. The newly added profiling option is available on the T-Mobile's privacy dashboard. T-Mobile appears to have silently enabled a new profiling toggle for its consumers by default. This feature seemingly allows the company to collect extensive personal data to better predict user behavior. Consumers must manually toggle it off for each line on their account. T-Mobile's history of questionable privacy practices continues with a newly discovered profiling toggle in its privacy center, first discovered by the Mobile Report. This new profiling toggle is set to on by default and enables the carrier to perform automated profiling of user data. The exact time frame remains unclear, but this concerning feature appears to have been active for at least a month, as evident by Reddit discussions. This is T-Mobile's description of the profiling feature in its privacy notice. Profiling is a specific type of activity under certain privacy laws and generally refers to the automated processing of personal data to evaluate, analyze, or predict certain personal aspects about your performance at work, economic situation, health, personal preferences, interests, reliability, behavior, location, or movements. You can opt out of having profiling used for future decisions that produce legal or similarly significant effects about you. This feature is meant to allow T-Mobile to use your data to create a behavioral profile which could be used to anticipate your needs or actions when seeking support. However, the broad definition opens the door for T-Mobile to collect a concerning amount of sensitive data, including location, interest, financial status, and even health information. Notably, users were never directly notified about this feature's addition or the policy change. Plus, the fact that the toggle is enabled by default raises certain concerns about breach of trust. As consumers, we should have the power to explicitly consent to this type of data collection rather than being forced to opt out manually. Well, here's how to opt out. To toggle this feature off, you can access T-Mobile's Privacy Center dashboard or follow these steps. Log into your T-Mobile account with full account permissions. On desktop, click Edit Profile Settings. On your mobile app, tap More Than Profile Settings. Find Privacy and Notifications and select Privacy Dashboard. Next, scroll down to find the Profiling and Automated Decisions section and turn it off. Unfortunately, T-Mobile does not allow you to turn off this feature for your entire account at once. You must repeat these for each individual line under your account. This is not the first time T-Mobile has quietly opted users into data collection practices. The rise of AI and data prediction is unavoidable, and companies' use of them is likely to become increasingly common. However, this growth must be accompanied by careful consideration of ethical implications and user privacy. AI spam is winning the battle against search engine quality. Google search results are being hammered by the proliferation of AI garbage, and the web giant's attempt to curb the growth of machine-generated drivel haven't helped all that much. It's so bad that John Gillham, founder and CEO of AI content detection platform, Originality.ai, said Google's losing its war on all that spammy, scammy content in its search results. John Gillham said, "What's clear right now is that there's no one spamming Google that's not doing it with AI. Not all AI content is spam, but I think right now all spam is AI content." Gillham's team has been producing monthly reports to track the degree to which AI-generated content is showing up in Google web search results. As of last month, about 10% of Google's results point to AI content. It's claimed, and that's after Google vowed to take down a whole host of websites that were pushing such trash. Google did these manual actions to try and win a battle, but then seemed to be sort of struggling with the algorithm being overrun by AI content. As AI content proliferates, there's also concern that we could end up in a model collapse situation as AIs ingest other AI-generated material and end up regurgitating other low-grade synthetic data. Gillham said his AI content recognition tech, which has been used to scan data sets for machine-generated information, can help, but it's not a total solution. Gillham said it's a step in trying to reduce that corruption of the data set, but I don't think it totally solves the problem. As always, in the age of an ever-worsening internet, caveat artificial intelligence, AI has become increasingly integrated into various aspects of our lives, from virtual assistants to legal proceedings and medical imaging. However, there are important caveats to consider when utilizing AI technologies. AirTag, like trackers for Android's Find My Device network, will start shipping in May. Google revealed that the Find My Device network is going live on Android, but the best part of the network is ways off. AirTag-like trackers for Android won't be coming until May 2024. The Find My Device network allows Android phones around the world to work together to track not only phones, but other offline objects such as headphones and dedicated tracking devices. That includes devices that function a lot like Apple's AirTag, which relies on a near-identical network that's powered by iPhones, except this time using Android phones and working through services built into Android phones. Last year, when Google first announced the network, we also got news on a few new trackers that will support the network from Chipolo and Pebblebee. These trackers have been available for pre-order since May of last year, and units will finally start shipping in May of this year. Both companies have confirmed that. Pebblebee confirmed this week that it will start shipping tag, card, and clip units designed to work with Android's Find My Device network in late May. The company will also sell its trackers through the Google Store starting in June. Pre-orders are open now in Pebblebee's website. The tag and card cost under $35, while the clip is under $30. Also shipping in May will be Chipolo's dual of Find My Device compatible trackers. Chipolo tells us that both its trackers will start shipping on May the 27th from the company's website and will be available at Amazon and other retailers in July. The Chipolo 1 point and 1 card cost about $28 and $35 respectively and are available for pre-order now. This late May release date from Find My Device Network compatible trackers puts the launch about a year after Google first released the Android feature. The lengthy timeline was due to a hefty delay that was waiting on Apple to build tracking protections into iOS, which is finally arriving in iOS 17.5. These trackers will work natively in Android, as Google shared a demo of what it will look like. Soon, some older PCs will lose Windows 11 support. Windows 11 will no longer support PCs with some older CPUs. Since its launch, Windows 11 has been plagued by compatibility issues due to its high spec demands that excluded plenty of PCs, but now even more will be left with a new update. The upcoming version of 24H2 update, which has been rumored to launch in September of 2024, will no longer boot on computers that use very old processors, specifically the kind that doesn't support the PopCNT or population count instruction. Many of the system files will require the PopCNT CPU or the population count instruction from the Windows 11 kernel to the USB XHCI drivers, meaning that any processors without it cannot run the operating system. PopCount was made standard in CPUs in the mid-2000s, starting with AMD's Barcelona architecture, followed by Intel's first-gen Core i-series processors. This means that PCs manufactured in the past 15 years shouldn't be affected by this new Windows 11 requirement. It also shouldn't affect modern PCs unsupported by the OS, so those who've managed to find a workaround would still be able to run Windows post-update. It makes sense from Microsoft's viewpoint to force users to run Windows 11 on newer machines. The 24H2 update will be ushering in some massive changes that will heavily focus on next-gen AI experiences, as well as various performance and security updates and new features. To ensure that all these new features actually work as planned with the operating system, Microsoft needs to make sure that spec requirements are up-to-date to run them, especially as it expands Microsoft Copilot support, since that's supposed to enhance the Windows interface and boost productivity in terms of apps, search, and more. And as off-putting as the growing emphasis on Copilot and other AI features and tools can be, at least Microsoft is only focusing on updating Windows 11 and doesn't seem to be in a hurry switching to a whole new operating system, such as Windows 12. While tempting such a move could fracture an already heavily divided user base that overwhelmingly still supports Windows 10. Dell sets new standards by saying fully remote workers are no longer eligible for promotions. In the world of remote work, there will always be discussions about its efficacy, both from employees and large companies. However, it's become more and more common for leaders to make decisions that favor their interests over their employees, especially those who tend to be happier and do better in remote work environments. Just a couple of years ago, Dell Technologies CEO Michael Dell said that remote work was here to stay, alluding to the future of the company being flexible for its employees. However, recent news disproved his claims. Dell employees are being forced into hybrid work if they want to be considered for promotions. The once progressive Dell Technologies has retracted its previous support for fully remote workers, saying they will no longer be eligible for promotions. In February, Dell told employees that to be eligible for promotions, they'll need to work a hybrid schedule from an approved office. Dell's new policy allows employees to stay fully remote. However, they're also urging employees to return to an approved office 3 times a week. It sounds like a great opportunity for flexibility. However, there's a catch. Employees who stay fully remote will not be qualified to apply for new positions at Dell or receive promotions. Not only is this pigeonholing people who choose to stay fully remote, but it also keeping them from achieving career advancement without the sacrifice of balance, family time, or personal health and wellness. Many employees are confused as to why they are being forced to turn their lives upside down to advance their careers. Many Dell employees who have anonymously spoken to Business Insider about this hybrid mandate feel forced to sacrifice upward mobility because of their personal lives. Dell's founder and CEO, Michael Dell, was previously considered progressive, supporting and even encouraging employees to take advantage of remote work for flexibility in their lives. This decision from Dell is dividing employees, with some senior leaders calling the practice not only anti-remote, but anti-women. Not only is it hurting people who are unable to physically leave their homes or travel to a new office, but it's also taking away the freedom of many employees who structure their lives around working from home, many of whom happen to be women. OpenAI and Microsoft planning $100 billion data center housing an AI supercomputer. It would be called Stargate. Microsoft and OpenAI are reportedly working on a massive data center to house an AI-focused supercomputer featuring millions of GPUs. The information reports that the project could cost in excess of $115 billion. And that the supercomputer currently dubbed Stargate inside OpenAI would be U.S.-based. The report says that Microsoft would foot the bill for the data center, which could be 100 times more costly than some of the biggest operating centers today. Stargate would be the largest in the string of data center projects the two companies hope to build in the next 6 years, and executives hope to have it running by 2028. OpenAI and Microsoft are building these supercomputers in phases, the report says, and that Stargate would be a Phase 5 system. A Phase 4 system would cost less and may launch as soon as 2026. The information source says, and may be looking to start in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin. The system could require several Stargate, could need so much power, at least several gigawatts, that Microsoft and OpenAI are considering alternative sources of power, such as nuclear. Sources suggested a data center of this scale would be challenging, partially because the existing designs require putting many more GPUs into a single rack than Microsoft is used to increase the chip's efficiency and performance. That means also devising novel ways to keep everything cool. It sounds like the companies are also potentially using this phase of design to move away from reliance on NVIDIA. The report claims that OpenAI wants to avoid using NVIDIA's InfiniBand cables in Stargate, even though Microsoft uses them in current projects. OpenAI claims it would rather use Ethernet cables. Much is still to be determined, so it seemed like the price and plans could all change, and it's unclear when details will be finalized. The information also states that it is yet to be determined where this computer will be located and whether it will be built in a single data center or in multiple data centers in close proximity. Earlier this year, reports stated that OpenAI CEO Sam Altman had ambitions to build AI chips and was looking to raise as much as $7 trillion to build foundries to produce them. Last year, Microsoft revealed its 128-core ARM data center CPU and Maia 100 GPUs specifically for AI projects. There have also been reports of Microsoft developing its own networking gear for AI data centers. As AI has taken off, NVIDIA GPUs have been in high demand. So it makes sense that companies like Microsoft and OpenAI might want to have some other options. We are always planning for the next generation of infrastructure, innovations needed to continue pushing the frontier of AI capability. Microsoft Chief Communications Officer Frank Shaw told the publication Information, though, that he apparently did not comment directly on the supercomputing plans. Microsoft has poured billions of dollars into its partnership with OpenAI, largely in the form of computing power to run its models. If Stargate or something like it comes to pass, the partnership will only grow deeper as the investments get larger and more complicated. The FCC to cut monthly broadband benefits because of funding shortfall. Some low-income families in the United States will see more expensive broadband bills starting next month when the Federal Communications Commission makes cuts to its monthly broadband benefits. The agency said the monthly benefits cuts are due to Congress not having approved further funding for the Affordable Connectivity Program. The program, which stopped accepting new applications in February, is aimed at helping low-income households afford the broadband needed for work, school, and more. Starting in May, the maximum subsidies for many in the program will fall to $14 less than half of the current $30 some currently receive for their broadband payments. For residents on tribal lands, the maximum monthly benefit will drop to $35, down from $75. Families who receive credit for certain devices will see the maximum amount fall to $47 from the current $100. The FCC said it is encouraging providers to keep consumers connected and noted providers can, but not obligated, to offer more discounts to households that are part of the program. It remains unclear exactly how providers will approach the situation starting next month. More than 20 million households are enrolled in the program, the FCC said. Last week, the FCC chair, Jessica Rosenworcel, called on Congress to take immediate action to prevent the funding shortfall. Today, more than 23 million households nationwide on the Affordable Connectivity Program get online and stay online, including vulnerable seniors, veterans, school-aged children, and residents of rural and tribal communities. Rosenworcel said, absent additional funding from Congress, the program will close. She urged lawmakers to pass the bicameral Affordable Connectivity Program Extension Act, which would dish out an additional $7 billion for the program. To fully participate in the digital age economy, every household needs access to broadband. We have come too far to allow this successful effort to promote internal access for all to end, she said. Google is pushing Gemini into another app on your Android phone. Yet another way Google is trying to make you use its AI helper. The Google app for Android is all set to gain a Gemini toggle. The new feature will allow Android users to use Gemini without downloading its dedicated Android app. Assemble Debug is an Android developer and tipster who shares insights about unreleased features in apps. Assemble Debug is a developer known for discovering and enabling pre-release features in apps, then sharing about them online to spread knowledge. Tipster Assemble Debug's expertise centers around debugging, software development, and enabling pre-release features in apps through code modifications. According to Tipster Assemble Debug's findings, Android users will soon see a Gemini switch inside the Google app on their devices. This is similar to how Google offers Gemini on its iOS app. Toggling to Gemini within the Google app lets you start an interaction with the AI by typing, talking, or sharing an image. So essentially, you move away from the traditional Google search and discover interface to the Gemini interface. The new option in the Google app for Android actually makes sense for users who wants to try out Gemini but don't want to lose Google Assistant functionality. Currently, if you download the Gemini app on your Android device, you have to opt in to remove Google Assistant and use only Gemini as the primary AI guide on your phone. A toggle to use Gemini within the Google app will overcome this restriction. There's no word on when the feature will roll out to the Google app for Android. But thanks to information from the tipster, you will see this roll out to the public. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and some of the different things that are going on in the recruiting field. I read this article, and this was an article that was rather interesting, and it talked about this kind of setup. You have a job interview. You go to this job interview in the early afternoon, and then late at night, you get this whole message. You get this text message. Hey, Benjamin, this is so-and-so, and I work at the office, and I was out of the office today. I heard you were there, and I heard that everybody was impressed with you. I'm sorry I didn't get to meet you. I'd love to connect with you sometime. I hope that can work. And then the expectations out of this test were that you would respond to this text in the middle of the night, that you would just do whatever it is that it took to respond right away, and you would respond to a job that you don't even have yet in the middle of the night. In the middle of the night. Let me say that once more. In the middle of the night. This is a warning bell that I, in my personal opinion, yes, I will respond to different messages in the middle of the night. That's not a problem. I'm in IT. We have to respond to them. But this kind of test starts to really impose upon people. This test was developed by this guy running an executive search firm down in Houston, Texas. And I will tell you that this is really breaking the boundaries of what we're supposed to expect. How so? Well, I mean, look, do you work 9 to 5? No, we typically work 8 to 5. We've got that hour lunch in the middle. But do you really expect your boss or any kind of contact at a company to be constantly bombarding you with messages day and night? I mean, this is a red flag to me. This is something that says, hey, we're going to expect you to put in the long, hard hours. We're going to expect you to work not just your 8 hour a day or maybe even an occasional 10 or 12. We're expecting you to work 16 hours a day every day, 7 days a week. Now, maybe this comes from somebody who's a little bit jaundiced, somebody who did actually burn out when he was 29 years old. But I will tell you that that's sort of a red flag that it needs to be resolved. How would I resolve it? In my case, yes, I would respond to them if I got that message at an appropriate time. Actually, at 10 o'clock p.m., my phone goes to silent. I do have a work phone when I am on call, and it will ring through if certain people call me. But that's kind of the exception to the rule. That's because I'm on call. That's because I'm expected to respond during certain hours. But when they're approaching you in any kind, I mean, if you're really, really desperate and unemployment is way up at, I don't know, we'll just throw out a number at 12% and you're desperate to find a new job, maybe you might give in to something like this. As for me, I would take the other route, and I would probably, if I'm going to respond to them, I'm going to respond to them in normal hours, in business hours. Now, fortunately, this particular article did go down the line of saying, actually, a lot of people don't even respond at all. They don't respond anywhere near that time. Look, the idea of communications as I grew up was you do not call anybody before 9 a.m. and never after 9 p.m. And the same thing should apply for texting. Okay, friends, relatives, maybe, but you have to be respectful of those hours. You have to be very careful about when you're reaching out to people. There's a two-way street here. There's a matter of you need, if you're an employer, to respect the boundaries of your employees. And likewise, they're going to respect you. And they're not going to call you in the middle of the night. They're going to try to deal with the issues that they can in a reasonable fashion. There are all kinds of these different tests that people put forward for, is this person going to be an ideal fit for our company? Is this person going to go through and do what we need them to? Okay, is this person crazy? Is this person going to be, you know, constantly doing all kinds of these manic hours that nobody really should be working? You know, that would actually, to me, I would say that would be a red flag. In the past, I've hired a number of people. I've gone through and I've hired so many technicians over the years or have been involved with the process. And during that, my goal was to respect everyone who walked through the door and give them a chance and give them a listen. I've been burned only probably, I would say two times. Really burned by the people that I interviewed and then hired when I had red flags for them. But that's going to happen. We always have those situations where we think, okay, we're going to forgive them for this. We're going to forgive them for that. But the tests that we need to put forward, the different requirements that we have, the expectations that we have need to be reasonable. And reaching out to somebody in the middle of the night to answer a tech question, to answer an interview question, to connect up for another interview. Yeah, that really doesn't fly with me. But who am I? Just another one of those computer nerds, Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. There have been many ads of free Microsoft Office software. Well, free Microsoft Office software may not mean free to use. It may just mean free to download, or free to install, or free to use after receipt of your credit card for a 30 days of trial usage before paying with your credit card. And you just have to remember to cancel before the trial expires to avoid being charged. Microsoft 365, formerly Microsoft Office, remains the gold standard of Office applications. But a standalone Microsoft Office license, that is, if you're not using the Microsoft 365 subscription service, is an expensive outlay. Note that Microsoft Office is now named Microsoft 365, with its various products and offshoots also changing name. So what is free to use? Well, there's Microsoft 365 Online, formerly known as Office Online. Microsoft itself offers a substantial collection of free Microsoft 365 utilities, once known as Office on the Web and Office Online. Microsoft 365 Online is a browser-based version of the latest Microsoft Office, Microsoft 365 Suite. Regardless of what it's called, it's a way to get Microsoft 365 for free. It currently includes Word, Excel, PowerPoint, OneNote, Sway, Mail, People, Calendar, and OneDrive. There is a catch, however. The online versions of Microsoft 365 apps only provide a limited Microsoft Office experience. Word Online, for example, does not include text boxes, word art, equations, charts, and more. You can still write a term paper, but you won't be able to compile a company report. Similarly, you can open and view your Excel spreadsheet, but your custom macros won't load. While Microsoft 365 Online lacks some functionality, it is a versatile free alternative to a fully paid Microsoft 365 license. The free Microsoft 365 versions will happily open your files, allow editing, and importantly, keep your document formatting in place at all times. For many, this may be all you need. So what else is free to use? Microsoft 365 mobile apps. Microsoft Office is available for free on Android and iOS. The Microsoft 365 mobile apps, formerly known as Microsoft Office Mobile, include reduced but functional versions of Microsoft Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. Microsoft has changed its Office Mobile app strategy a few times, switching between standalone and unified Office apps, and has renamed its entire suite Microsoft 365. Now, how functional you find Microsoft 365 mobile app comes down to the size of the screen you're using. For instance, editing a Word document on my phone is reasonable, but attempting to navigate an Excel spreadsheet can be frustrating. Conversely, editing a Word or Excel document on a larger tablet-sized screen is actually Well, it can be enjoyable. Android and iOS users can currently use a unified Microsoft 365 app that includes Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. The Microsoft 365 app also includes Microsoft Lens, the document scanning tool, a PDF conversion tool, instant file sharing between nearby devices, and image and data extraction from files and spreadsheets. That said, the standalone versions of the apps are still available on Google Play and the App Store, meaning you can pick and choose the apps you want. The standalone Microsoft 365 apps also include OneDrive, Outlook, OneNote, and SharePoint, among others. However, if you want the standalone Microsoft 365 apps to keep using Microsoft Office free that way, there are links from Android devices from the Microsoft Corporation App Store page, which also includes links to various free Microsoft 365 apps for iPhone and iPad. Previously, there was a second free trial you could pick up for Office 365 Pro Plus. However, since that service changed its name to Microsoft 365 Apps for Enterprise, the free trial is unfortunately no longer available. Microsoft 365 rarely comes bundled with new desktop or laptop, unless it is a specific introductory deal. You'll be purchasing Microsoft 365 as an add-on. That said, these types of deals aren't impossible. You just have to be lucky and strike while the iron is hot. Then you may be able to get free-to-use Microsoft Office if you happen to be an employee of an employer or school. First, you'll have to check with your employer, or if you're a student, your school. Many companies and schools can offer either a free or extremely low-cost Microsoft 365 license for one reason. The people working or studying there need it. Businesses will have to pay, but bulk licenses may mean your employer can provide a free or cheap option. Furthermore, Microsoft has long supported schools with free Office 365 education packages. It might be that you have to ask directly, what about a Microsoft 365 lifetime license? If a free Microsoft 365 license doesn't grab you, why not consider a Microsoft Office lifetime license? Well, for one good reason, they don't exist. You might see websites advertising a Microsoft 365 lifetime license. You'll even find this deal on some reputable tech sites. But the reality is that once you click through the first page, you end up on a product key site where you'll likely purchase a Microsoft 365 volume key. For one thing, we do know is that product key sites are never clear where their miraculous, cheap, and incredible lifetime license come from, and more than a few volume keys have been revoked. Buyers beware. While the 365 mobile apps are limited, they are very functional, especially on larger screens. The pros and cons of noise-canceling headphones. Noise-canceling headphones may benefit your ears, but too much noise reduction can alter how your brain processes sound. Noise-canceling headphones are designed to reduce the amount of external noise that reaches the ear, allowing the user to listen to audio content without being disturbed by their surroundings. While they are generally considered good for your ears, by reducing the overall noise levels you're exposed to, it's a myth that technology is entirely good for us. Online forums are full of people complaining about ear pain, nausea, and headaches from noise-canceling headphones. These forums largely share the same theory that active noise canceling is dangerous because it puts harmful pressure on your eardrum. However, that's not quite right either. According to David McAlpin, the academic director of Macquarie University Hearing, there's a simpler explanation. Not hearing your environment is unnatural. McAlpin says noise-canceling headphones lower the volume that reaches your ears, which is a good thing for your hearing. Using active noise-canceling likely means you don't have to drown out background noise by listening to music at high volumes. The Centers for Disease Control, that's the CDC, and prevention says listening to loud sounds for long periods can lead to hearing impairment. However, too much noise reduction can be dangerous. McAlpin says your brain overcompensates to active noise canceling by turning up its internal gain. He says this creates a listening loss, as operating at an increased sensitivity alters your neural pathways. McAlpin wrote in a paper that was published in 2011, coining the term hidden hearing loss, referring to our brain's inability to process sound rather than our ears' inability to hear it. McAlpin said that if you have a listening loss, it's likely changing your brain's encryption. Even if you can change what you are hearing, you may not get back to the brain state that you had before. It's not reversible. McAlpin describes what happens when people enter his university's anechoic chamber, a virtually soundless environment. He says people feel disoriented and describe a pressure in their head and ears. The sensations are remarkably similar to when people use active noise canceling. The common thread is that your body is not made to experience total silence, so people react poorly without background noise. There's a disconnect between what you're experiencing and what you're hearing. Intense sound damages your hearing, so there are situations where noise-canceling headphones benefit you, McAlpin said. At the same time, background noise, features of the soundscape, are critical to orienting yourself in an environment. A 2012 study from McAlpin, co-author on hidden hearing loss, asked 17 subjects to wear earplugs for a week. 11 participants developed tinnitus, a common medical condition where someone perceives a ringing or buzzing noise with no external source. The study proved that audio deprivation can affect how your brain processes sound, even if your ears are unharmed. However, the condition disappeared after subjects removed their earplugs, so you shouldn't worry about your noise-canceling headphones giving you long-term tinnitus. So, while active noise-canceling can be good for your ears, it could also be altering your brain's listening ability. The truth is, there's a trade-off every time you use active noise-canceling. You're hearing the world at a different sensitivity and what McAlpin calls an altered gain state. Spending enough time in this state can make it difficult for your brain to listen at normal audio levels. McAlpin said, I do think that we've let big tech companies co-opt our listening habits, monetize it, and sell it back to us. Their solution to the hearing problem is probably creating a listening problem. However, it's understandable to believe that because something hurts your ears, it's bad for your ears. And the myth is rooted in some truth. If you do find active noise canceling painful in any way, the technology could be messing with your brain's perception of your environment and triggering some kind of instinctual discomfort. Noise canceling headphones have become fairly commonplace in our society because the modern world is increasingly noisy. Cars, planes, construction, and electronics contribute to a far noisier world than our ancestors had. Likewise, our hearing problems are getting worse as our brains and ears struggle to keep up with the changing times. The issue noise-canceling headphones try to address is a serious one. Noise pollution has been linked to a higher rate of cardiovascular disease and is being increasingly recognized as a harmful pollutant, similar to air and light. Plus, other studies have found that noise-canceling headphones can help improve your focus. So we're left with a trade-off. Noise-canceling headphones may protect your ears, but non-stop use of them can alter your brain's listening ability. Ideally, you should only use noise-canceling headphones when you're being exposed to excess noise, on trains and planes, or in a noisy city. They're probably a good idea. However, if you're in a quiet environment, you may be better off just listening to the world around you. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now. Marty, what do you have for us this week?
Oh, this is a new take on an old safety mechanism. So let's talk about old first.
Okay.
If you watch a lot of old TV or movies, you've seen, you know, lovely and chase scenes and crimes and all that. The traditional open frame steel fire escapes that in their day were the only back stairway survival routes for occupants of tall structures.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. If you've ever seen a residential fire escape ladder at somebody's home,
mm-hmm.
odds are it was a chain. And even fit mm-hmm. people who aren't used to climbing chain ladders may not feel too secure trying to use one.
Yeah.
Well, I just got in an amazing new kind of solution from Safer Escape.
Okay.
When you don't need it, it's an aluminum strut next to one of your outside windows. It's on the outdoor side. Need to make a hasty exit?
Okay.
Pull the pin, swing it out. There's two bars in it. And one side comes down, and you're soon on a solid aluminum ladder with for real aluminum rungs.
Okay, sounds nice.
As it happens, my next door neighbor is a veteran contractor, and he was very impressed with how well this is built. So was I, for that matter.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You might be, too. It comes in a lot of different lengths, colors, and styles, so prices for your house are hard to predict. But okay. unless you live somewhere that is forever immune to combustion, do a little exploring at saferescape.com. And that's all one word, saferescape.com.
I'm going to check into that. It's something that sounds very we don't think about safety enough for our houses. And you know, my office is the second story. So, yeah.
I've heard more stories than that come out of your office.
Fair enough.
Speaking of stories.
Yes.
We have a favorite company because they send us gift boxes that we don't have to ask for.
Let's see here. I'm going to guess Client Tools.
Oh, what a guess. So I'm going to rush through a list of what I got in recently.
Yeah.
There's a digital angle gauge with angle alert. A digital mm-hmm. multimeter with continuity tester, receptacle tester, and GFCI tester, and a breaker finder.
Mm-hmm.
A 7-in-1 impact socket set, all fit on a single shaft of a single handle, size of 1/4 to 9/16.
Mm-hmm.
A pocket red laser level with 3-axis adjustable mount, magnets, and 3 integrated bubble levels.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, if you're not on the level with that, 25-foot extension cord with bright daylight visible white LEDs in end plug and socket.
Oh, okay. I like the sound of that one.
Oh, yeah. A 15-foot compact tape measure. They're not tame. They're tape measures. This one's nylon coated. One side across reads across. The other reads up and down. A conveniently thin, and you like this one, I know, Mod Box. Tool or component holder
that
can snap to the top of the Klein Tools rollabout stacks or to the bottom of their backpacks.
Okay.
They carry tools. You can carry wire nuts. You can carry whatever you need to the job site. And it's right there, secure, clamped in a couple of 3 different ways. You're not going to leave a trail of work.
Mm-hmm.
So, Klein, thank you. I'm going to mention one other item that I got it, and this is kind of a treat. It's from AOC.
Okay.
It's
the Congresswoman?
No, I'm sorry. No, it's not. A monitor company.
Oh, yes, yes. I'm familiar with them. Yeah, very nice monitors.
This is their – the box says Work Mode Freedom Totable Monitor. When I talked to them, they just said it's their portable monitor. It's their 16T3EA monitor. And what it is, looks like a tablet.
It's just
a panel.
Mm-hmm.
And the panel has fold-out back easel mounts.
Okay, nice.
It's got a USB-C connection,
mm-hmm.
power switch, and a couple other switches control things at the top. Well, reviewing was really hard. I walked over to my notebook computer. I plugged in a USB-C cable, plugged it into that. Now I've got an extension of my laptop screen.
Very nice. Okay, yes. I've seen those before. I haven't picked up one. I'm wavering on the edge of if I want to do this. So tell me more about this.
I'll tell you a little bit more. We are looking at a 15.6-inch wide screen.
Okay. Yeah.
30 to 85 horizontal scan rate. That's K, of course.
Yeah. What's the resolution on it? I'm presuming at 15.6, it's a 2K screen, 1920 by 1080.
Yeah, at 60 hertz.
Okay.
You're correct.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a Visa plug and play. Runs on 5 volts, which is USB
C. Yeah, yeah.
Uses 7 watts of power. Can you spare that?
7 watts. Okay. I had not really thought about how low the wattage would be on that. And now, so does it do the pass through for that? How does that work with the connection? Do you plug the power port, the USB-C power into the monitor and then the cable over to the...
There's only one USB-C connection. And if you have a notebook with only one USB-C connection, you're done.
Okay.
It powers it and provides...
Yeah, but you have to be on battery for that. So,
No, you don't. You don't have to be on battery for that.
So in my case, I've got a USB-C into my laptop.
Oh, I see. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I'm out of luck there.
What did you buy, Dell? I keep telling Michael, don't do that stuff.
What can I say? As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that's Marty Winston.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, April the 25th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. and the topic of presentation is What is an AIPC? Online Zoom virtual meeting. And the website is bcug.com. Tech Ed Connect meets Thursday, May the 2nd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, May the 3rd. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, May the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, May the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is limac.org. The Kingsbyte Computer Club meets Tuesday, May the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. And they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. To confirm, the phone number is 347-278-7320. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.